I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's August 18th, and we have a lot to talk about. Since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, we've seen and heard a lot about the impact of the pandemic on our frontline workers. I think that the work being performed by our healthcare professionals has been and continues to be extraordinary and heroic. I also think that there's another group of frontline workers that are very often overlooked, and I'm talking about family caregivers. Any mental health professional will tell you that caregiving can be a stressful undertaking, and adding the stress of a global pandemic, the stress of worrying whether the family member you're caring for is more highly susceptible to getting the virus or getting a more serious case if they are diagnosed with COVID-19, has made the role of family caregiver, well, a lot more stressful than it was before. In fact, a newly published survey from the University of Pittsburgh offers a peek at how millions of caregivers, including MS caregivers, might be feeling right about now. Now, just before our lockdown began, I sat down to talk with my friend and caregiving comrade, Marianne Sterling. Marianne was a caregiver and healthcare advocate for her parents for over 20 years. She's a speaker, writer, and educator on the challenges of family caregiving. Marianne serves as an advisor for the National Alzheimer's and Dementia Patient and Caregiver-Powered Research Network, bringing the voices of patients and family caregivers to medical research. She also serves on the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute Translation Center Technical Expert Panel and on the Data and Safety Monitoring Board for the Fall Injuries Prevention Partnership Trial. And while our conversation took place before the pandemic hit the United States, I find the content to be as valid today as it was on the day that we spoke. But before we get to my conversation with Marianne Sterling, there are a few other things that you should know about. Last week, a research team at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center published the results of a study that showed that decreasing the amount of a protein made in the liver significantly reduced disease activity or eliminated it altogether in mice with the mouse version of MS. Now, this discovery had its start a few years ago at the University of Texas Southwestern, when in 2016, Dr. Joaquin Hertz and his team showed that reducing the levels of a protein called reelin protected mice from atherosclerosis. The research team found that reelin regulates a production of adhesion molecules on blood vessel walls, and these adhesion molecules capture a type of inflammation-producing immune cell called monocytes. When the scientists decreased the level of reelin in animal models, they saw that levels of this adhesion molecule also decreased, preventing the molecules from capturing monocytes and causing inflammation. So the research team wondered whether reelin played the same role in other inflammatory diseases, and they investigated the role of reelin in relapsing-remitting multiple sclerosis. They found that reelin levels were about the same in patients when their MS was in remission and people who didn't have MS. However, they observed that reelin levels were elevated in MS patients during a relapse. The team's findings suggested that reelin levels might correlate with MS severity, and that lowering reelin levels might be a way to treat MS. The scientists began working with mice affected by EAE, which is often referred to as the animal model or mouse model of MS, because it closely mimics MS in humans. The mice were genetically modified so that the research team could control reelin production, and they found that eliminating reelin substantially mitigated or eliminated the paralysis caused by EAE. The research team went on to eliminate reelin in mice that hadn't been genetically altered, And they found they were able to prevent paralysis by giving the mice antibodies that inactivated reelin in their systems, altering reelin levels to reduce immune cells' ability to accumulate and cause inflammation may represent a whole new strategy for treating MS. So this is encouraging news. And I'll follow this news with my usual disclaimer. There are large differences between mice and humans. So it's far from a sure thing to think that something that works in mice will work the same way in people. But this discovery represents a new path for scientists to continue to follow, and that in itself is encouraging news. Now, if you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Science has shown us that disease-modifying therapies can make a difference in quality of life today, and they can also delay disability in the future. That sounds like a pretty good deal. And the first disease-modifying therapies that were available to people living with MS were injectable. Now, that didn't sound like a particularly good deal to a lot of people. So today, there are disease-modifying therapies like Gilenya, Tecfidera, and Aubagio, which can be taken orally once or twice a day. And that sounds a lot more user-friendly. Now, you might think that realizing the benefits of taking a disease-modifying therapy and having the added benefit of making it an oral therapy would sort of be a no-brainer, but apparently it isn't. A new study that looked at real-world use by examining data like the number of days between having prescriptions refilled showed that 20%, or 1 in 5 MS patients, fail to stay on their daily oral disease-modifying therapy. And about 1 in 4 stop using a daily oral disease-modifying therapy within just 1 year. And these sorts of decisions carry some real-world consequences. Poor adherence or discontinuation of disease-modifying therapy has been linked to worse clinical outcomes, higher rates of relapse, greater disease progression, higher hospitalization rates, and no one should be making conscious decisions that lead to these kinds of outcomes. MS can be hard enough. No one needs to be giving the disease an extra push. This news shows that there's an opportunity to do better, and this is something that every person living with MS can do for themselves. Either stay on your disease-modifying therapy, or if you have concerns about your current disease-modifying therapy, talk with your neurologist about whether making a change might make sense. But the outcome of simply stopping is that everything gets worse. And when it comes to your health and well-being, well, that shouldn't be anyone's goal. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Between 70 and 90% of the people with MS develop some bladder dysfunction, which puts them at risk for urinary tract infections, or UTIs. And the National MS Society points out that UTIs can actually worsen other MS symptoms and even lead to relapses. And when a UTI reaches the kidneys, well, that's when serious medical complications can set in. And that's why it's worth noting that this month, the first non-invasive at-home UTI test kit is going to be launched in the United Kingdom. The way it will work is that a mobile app will scan a QR code to inform the app of the type of test being conducted. Then users collect a urine sample in a clean container and dip a testing strip in. To get the results, users rescan the QR code and they get the results of their test in plain English in just 2 minutes. The app also advises the user if further medical attention is needed, and it can even share the test results with a doctor if the user chooses. The at-home kit comes with 2 test strips and will sell for about 10 British pounds or 13 US dollars. Now, there's been previous research that's shown that UTI test strips have not been as reliable as they need to be, some with an accuracy rate as low as 30%. So hopefully this kit is going to offer some major improvements in the area of accuracy. And while the state of the art may not be where it needs to be today, technology continues to evolve. So you can be sure we'll continue to see improvements in the reliability of these at-home tests and the number of people who take advantage and save themselves a trip back and forth to the clinic. Outside of the United States, the country with the greatest number of Real Talk MS listeners is Canada. And that shouldn't come as a surprise, because Canada has one of the highest rates of MS in the world. About 77,000 Canadians are living with multiple sclerosis, and every day, 11 more Canadians are diagnosed with MS. So I want to make sure everyone knows that this Thursday, August 20th, is the 12th annual Burgers to Beat MS Day at A&W restaurants throughout Canada. And what that means is that this Thursday, A&W is going to donate $2 to the MS Society of Canada for every A&W teen burger sold. And because of the unique circumstances that the world finds ourselves in, to keep everyone safe, this year's event is the first Takeout Burgers to Beat MS Day. And there are a few different ways that you can choose to participate. Obviously, on August 20th, you can buy a teen burger to go. And hopefully, you can buy many teen burgers to go. But you don't have to wait until Thursday. Right now, you can add a donation when you place an order through A&W's mobile app. You can round up your bill when you make any purchase at A&W. And you can even make an online donation at burgerstobeatms.ca. And if you choose to purchase a Burgers to Beat MS e-gift card online, A&W will match the value of your gift card through a corporate donation to the MS Society of Canada. The goal this year is to raise more than $1 million, bringing the total amount raised in support of the MS Society of Canada by the amazing folks at A&W to more than $15 million. And that money goes toward funding MS research and supporting the well-being of people living with MS throughout Canada. So if you live in Canada, I hope you plan on stopping at your local A&W on Thursday and supporting Takeout Burgers to Beat MS Day. And if you don't live in Canada, well, you can still contribute to Burgers to Beat MS by making an online donation. And you'll find a link to that online donation page in today's show notes. During the COVID-19 pandemic, we've seen and heard a lot in the media about how the pandemic was impacting frontline workers. I happen to believe that one group of frontline workers that's been consistently overlooked are family caregivers. There's plenty of research to remind us that without a global pandemic, being a caregiver is stressful work, and the stress can come from any number of directions, whether it's dealing with a family member or loved one who's having their own mood issues, or the financial challenges faced by most every family affected by chronic illness, or arguing with insurance companies, advocating with healthcare professionals on behalf of a loved one. It's a long list. And if a family caregiver isn't incorporating positive self-care strategies into their daily routine, this all too often leads to caregiver burnout, and then we have two people in need of care. So the National Rehabilitation Research and Training Center on Family Support at the University of Pittsburgh conducted a survey of over 3,500 family caregivers and non-caregivers living in and around Allegheny County, Pennsylvania. They wanted to measure how these folks were being impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, these were not all MS caregivers, but as I've said before, while there are sometimes tremendous differences between one chronic illness and another, I've seen the challenges that go along with being a caregiver are actually quite similar. So I find the information in this survey to be pretty universal, whether you're a caregiver for someone living with MS, Parkinson's, cancer, COPD, or so many other chronic conditions. And the key findings of this survey revealed that 43% of the caregivers felt that their mental health was worse than before the COVID-19 pandemic. 27% of the caregivers also said that their physical health was worse, and this compared to 18% of the non-caregivers. 43% of the caregivers reported that their family finances were worse than they were before the pandemic. 29% said that since the start of the pandemic, they were more worried about having enough food and being able to pay for food. And 31% of the caregivers said that their ability to access healthcare was worse than before the pandemic. The co-director of the National Rehabilitation Research and Training Center on Family Support noted that the responses from caregivers were unusually consistent, regardless of whether the caregiver was young or old, regardless of their level of education or income level, regardless of whether they were caring for someone with a mental or physical disability, or whether they were caring for a younger or older patient. These are sobering statistics that represent the real challenges facing a group that isn't even counted when you think about all those who may be impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. Hopefully, these survey results will help focus the efforts and attention of public health officials and healthcare providers on providing relief for family caregivers who aren't always the first to focus their own attention on their own very real needs. If you'd like to review the details of this survey, I'll include a link in today's show notes. As most of you know, I've experienced the challenges of caregiving firsthand, and I found that while people living with different chronic illnesses can have a very different sort of patient journey, caregivers tend to walk a very similar path. In a moment, we'll meet my guest, an expert on the challenges faced by family caregivers, Marianne Sterling. I met my guest, Marianne Sterling, at the Medicine X conference at Stanford University, and after listening to the first couple of minutes of her presentation, it was apparent that we had a lot in common. Marianne was a caregiver and healthcare advocate for her parents for more than 20 years, and I've been a caregiver and healthcare advocate for my wife, Jean, for just over 20 years. So I realized right away that we both knew the secret handshake. We were both members of that club that no one ever really applies to get into. We were both caregivers. Welcome to the podcast, Marianne.
Thank you, John. Great to be with you today.
I found that while people living with different chronic illnesses may have very different journeys, with just a few exceptions, a caregiver's journey is remarkably the same. So tell me, how and for whom, and in your case, for how many family members, did you find yourself one day assuming the role of a family caregiver?
Sure. In fact, my husband and I ended up with 3 out of our 4 parents being diagnosed with dementia, different types of dementia, in fact. And we had a caregiving journey that spanned multiple decades. It's kind of hard to describe, but think of it this way. My dad started showing first signs of dementia when I was a teenager. So that was in the late 1970s, if you can believe that. And after he passed away, my mom started showing signs of dementia as well. And when we were on that journey, toward the end of that journey in 2013, my father-in-law was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. So it was, a journey of more than 40 years for me personally. I don't usually reveal this little secret, but I'm 53 now. So it's been a while since I was a teenager.
I'll just say you're a very youthful 53, but go ahead.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that. But, you know, it's been a journey that was, of course, evergreening, ever-changing. Sometimes we had one of our parents in our home with us. More typically, we had a parent living either independently or trying to live independently in assisted living or even in long-term care. We were sometimes the main caregivers. Sometimes we were the secondary caregivers. For instance, in my dad's case, my mom was the primary caregiver, and I was a close second. And of course, in my father-in-law's case, my mother-in-law was the primary caregiver, and my husband was the secondary caregiver. So we have seen, I think, almost every different permutation of this over the span of multiple decades.
You know, you're a leading advocate for family caregivers. I know you contribute research, writing, speaking. You serve as a PCORI ambassador. And to remind my listeners, PCORI is shorthand for the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute. So I'm wondering, what do you see as the greatest set of unmet needs of family caregivers?
You know, we all know that caregiving situations are diverse. It could be that, in my case, I was caring for aging parents, but you could just as easily be caring for a spouse or a child who's chronically ill. But I think universally, our needs include support from family, friends, and community. It's not that easy either, as we all know. Our country lacks the infrastructure to support us as caregivers. So it's difficult to navigate our healthcare system, our social services systems. They don't talk to one another. And trying to find resources, community services that you may need in your home along the way is extraordinarily difficult. So I think as a caregiving community, it's that infrastructure that is distinctly missing.
Self-care is important for all of us, yet it's something that consistently gets overlooked by so many family caregivers. And of course, that only leads to additional challenges down the road. What do you think family caregivers can do to continue managing their own lives as they take on caregiving responsibilities or even see those caregiving responsibilities increase over time?
You know, that's a great question, and one that I have struggled with over the years for myself. It is very difficult when you're in a tough caregiving situation to think about yourself and think about your own needs. But it's extremely important to do so because, as we all know, if the caregiver goes down, then that caregiving situation is going to fall apart, and it's going to fall apart quickly. So I think having a community of friends, family, colleagues, neighbors who pitch in and help remind you and help support you in caring for yourself. And that could be as simple as somebody coming in to take over for you in perhaps a companion care capacity. So you can go to lunch with your friends. Or maybe a neighbor says, hey, come on, let's go for a walk this evening. The weather's great. And this neighbor over here is going to come make sure that your loved one's okay while we're walking. It's the little things that add up to be a lot when it comes to caring for ourselves and making sure we can take those steps forward that we need to.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think sometimes being able to reconnect a caregiver with just the normalcy of everyday life, being able to take a walk or go to lunch with a friend. These sound like little things, but you know, I think that so often life, day-to-day life, is made up of little things. And those are the things that I think as caregivers don't have the opportunity or don't give themselves the opportunity to stay connected to some of those things, those everyday kinds of small things. I think that really adds to that sense of isolation that is so easy for a caregiver to kind of fall into.
Absolutely. And I think we often, when we hear the words, are you taking care of yourself? We sort of jump to the conclusion that, you know, I don't have time to start a new exercise program. I don't have time to go on vacation for a month. So to your point, it's about the little things that are good, and they're all going to add up and make a difference in the end.
I think you made an important point just a minute or two ago, you mentioned the fact that there are different kinds of caregiving relationships. Sometimes it can be parent-child, sometimes it's a spousal relationship, sometimes it's a combination or all of the above at the same time. But I think that what can happen sometimes as someone takes on the role of a family caregiver is they risk seeing the dynamics of those relationships change. I'm wondering, what do you think might be the best solution to preserve those relationships so that, for instance, one partner still defines their relationship with their spouse in healthy terms instead of as a patient caregiver relationship, or a parent still has a sense of their role as their adult child may be taking on more caregiving responsibilities?
You know, this is a particularly tough question. I probably failed at a lot of those challenges along the way. When you're a caregiving family, inevitably the dynamic is going to change somewhat. I think it comes back again to ensuring that caregivers have the support they need. Family dynamics, in my opinion, tend to take the biggest hit when families don't have the support they need, when the situation is extraordinarily tense and stressful all the time. Now, you're never going to get rid of all the stress of caregiving, let's be clear, but having a support system around you is going to allow you to focus more on making sure that those relationships stay intact.
I'm glad you mentioned the stress of caregiving, because too often that stress leads to depression. And from there, it can be a very short path to caregiver burnout. And then we have that situation you mentioned earlier where the caregiver goes down. And now we have two problems. We have to give care to the caregiver, and yet we also need to figure out how to best support the family member they were supporting. So what can a caregiver who's listening to us today do to reduce some of that stress and maintain better emotional balance?
That's a great question, John. And I think the answer lies in making sure that you have activities, places that you turn for healthy engagement. That could be spiritual engagement. That could be something that helped me a lot was exercise. Although that doesn't mean I had a whole lot of time to do it. But even getting outdoors for that quick walk is going to keep you physically and mentally healthy as well. That could be reading. So find that special engagement that gives you sort of a sense of self again, that helps clear your head and keeps that stress at bay as much as it can be in your situation.
I think that's great advice, and I know, and I've echoed it often. What I try to impress upon the caregivers that I get to talk with is when they're thinking about the things they need to do that day. So they need to maybe get medication ready, or maybe take a family member to an appointment, or whatever the seemingly endless list of tasks might be. You need to put down that walk or that time to read or that thing for you, because it is as important to get that done as everything else so that you can be there for that family member.
You know, and I think you hit on something there. Think of it this way. If there's a possibility that somebody else can take your loved one to an appointment and take over for a little bit to allow you to get that personal time, that stress-free time for yourself, take that opportunity. You may feel that, you know, gosh, I really have to be at that appointment. It's important for me to be there listening. Well, you know what? It's just as important for you to take time for yourself and breathe. So if you can find someone that you trust who can step in and take over and provide that transportation and support at a doctor's appointment, for example, that frees you up to get that moment that you need to keep going.
Sometimes finding that help is easier than actually seeing it, because I think it's all around you. Every time someone you know says, hey, if you ever need anything, let me know. All of us are conditioned to say, okay, I will, or thanks. But you need to be a lot more specific than that. When somebody makes that offer, you need to be able to say, that's so kind of you. It would mean a lot if you could take Jim to his appointment next Tuesday if you're free. Or, thank you so much. It would really be great if when you went grocery shopping, you wouldn't mind picking up an extra few items that, of course, I'm happy to pay for, but it would really save me a trip that's sometimes difficult for me to make. You just need to graciously accept those offers of help, but then respond to them.
I agree. And wouldn't it be awesome if we start to do this and sort of turn this into the fabric of caregiving moving forward, so that we have caregiving-friendly communities where, you know, others are helping us as much as they can, which allows us to keep our caregiving situation as stress-free as possible for a longer period of time.
Well, that's going to become more and more important, because as the practice of medicine continues to evolve and science continues to find ways to extend our lives, the number of family caregivers is going to continue to grow. I mean, we're seeing that trend happening in real time right before our eyes. Outside of family and social connections, what sort of societal changes from business, from employers, from local, state, or federal government, do you think we need to see to ensure that family caregivers are equipped to not only provide the necessary care for their loved ones, but to be able to fulfill their role as caregivers without losing themselves in the process?
I think there are a lot of steps we can take. I'm excited, actually. Some legislation that was signed in 2018 established the RAISE Family Caregiver Council. It was actually called the RAISE Family Caregiver Act. That's what was signed into law. We now have a council that is responsible for creating a strategy nationwide to help better support our caregivers. So maybe we'll finally have that infrastructure and sort of interwoven fabric that we so desperately need across the caregiving continuum. I'm really excited about that, John. And you can find more information on that. It's the RAISE Family Caregiver Council is actually convened by the Administration for Community Living, ACL. And you can find more information at acl.gov.
Challenges to caregiving can be considerable. Caregiver needs a game plan to not only ensure that their loved ones are thriving, but that they continue to thrive. And I think that as more and more people find themselves in the role of family caregivers, this becomes an ongoing conversation. So, Marianne Sterling, thank you for your thought leadership on this issue today, and I look forward to continuing this conversation with you in the future.
Thanks, John. It's been a pleasure to talk to you today.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society, and you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/155. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. And before we close things out, I'd like to invite you to leave a rating and review for Real Talk MS by visiting realtalkms.com/review. When you get there, you'll see the options for where you can leave that rating and review, Just click on any one of them. It'll take you less than 2 minutes, and it would mean a lot to me. I don't think I have to tell anyone listening to this podcast that the COVID-19 pandemic has intensified and in some cases multiplied the challenges of living with MS, from having difficulty affording MS medications to adjusting to increased isolation to coping with the added uncertainty of wondering how you or your family might be personally affected by COVID-19. More than ever before, people living with MS need access to reliable information, support, and connection. We're witnessing that even during a pandemic, MS doesn't stop, and neither does the National MS Society. So they've established the National MS Society COVID-19 Response Fund to ensure that the Society can continue meeting the urgent and expanding needs of the MS community during these unprecedented times. During the pandemic, we've seen the MS Society create virtual programming and virtual support groups literally on the fly so that no one has to face MS alone. They've created resources and provided information so that doctors and nurses can deliver the very best care. They've continued to amplify the voices of the MS movement to influence critical public policy decisions, and they've never stopped advancing research to find cures for MS. I know that these are financially tough times for an awful lot of people, but I'm asking that as you're able, please make a donation to support the National MS Society. To donate, you can simply text the word GIVE to 68686, and you'll get a link right to the MS Society's COVID-19 Response Fund webpage. And I hope you'll contribute today. It's never been more important. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.